And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. This is Mally, aka Docu Vixen, and it is Saturday again, and we have a packed up show, so I'm going to go right into it. We first start with Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
The nation will burst with song and celebration of the life, life's work, triumphs, and sacrifice of Martin Luther King Jr. Alas, the sad truth is that they will be celebrating and singing about a man who did not exist. Now, I don't mean that King didn't live. I mean that the man shown in books, in news accounts, and is taught of, if taught at all, in school books, didn't exist. He was, like all men, complex. He could be serious or funny, elated or depressed, according to his mood, and what challenges he faced. He wasn't a saint, his sister Christine King Ferris said, but an average, ordinary man. What made him extraordinary was the movement of which he was a part, and which he partly led. In essence, the freedom struggle made Martin L. King, and not the reverse. He became, through that struggle, far more radical than he would have been without it. The King you see and hear today is like Hollywood, softened, sweetened, and made digestible for mass consumption. Today's King is, I have a dream, cool and cerebral, easy to take. The man himself, just weeks after his historic Beyond Vietnam speech, where he condemned U.S. government violence in the Vietnam War, racism, materialism, and capitalism, was telling his staff on retreat, I can't be neutral on this, adding, the word of God is upon me, and it's like fire shut up in my bones, and I just have to tell it. War, racism, and poverty weren't just wrongs. They were evils. He caught the full brunt of criticism, attack, and condemnation from the so-called liberal press, like the Washington Post, and many of his allies who joined up to shout him down, saying he should stick to civil rights and not war, racism, or poverty. He was a giant of a man because he stood with the bombed, the poor, and the dispossessed. And yet, several weeks ago, here in a prison, I heard something that stunned me. A young man, about 20, approached an older man with the following question. Hey, old head, was Martin Luther King a rapper? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Luxembourg and Occupy. Meine Freunde, wie geht's? I recently did a thought experiment of Rosa Luxemburg and gave her a role in advising the young activists. I will not repeat that practice. Her spirit, however, of principled resistance to imperialism and advocacy of revolution over reform endears her to us and informs young activists involved in struggle against the U.S. empire. As the Occupy movement is still with us, and finding new ways of trying to live lives consonant with the spirit of Occupy, we think of it as a new year dawns, and try to draw lessons for movements active today and ones to come. Initially, we must note that Occupy is an American phenomenon, but there are similar expressions in other parts of the world, like the Indignados in Spain, the Arab Spring in North Africa, the Movimiento Sem Terra, the Landless Peasants Movement in Brazil, and beyond. All of these movements share something fundamental, a discontent with the status quo, and a deep desire for change. They each know that the status quo is untenable, that the state is an instrument of the wealthy, and that the present economic system is rapacious when it comes to using its power to protect the well-to-do. In a word, they know that the system is broken irrevocably. They also know that capitalism is to blame, namely the crisis of capitalism, which is raging to make more and more money from any conceivable outlet. Rosa Luxemburg would have loved to be around, not just to see the effects of that crisis, but to teach the lessons of organizing and revolution growing. And while it would be premature to call some of these movements revolutionary, they are certainly radical in that they are calling into question the systems under which we live. including capitalism. In the U.S., the Occupy movement struck quite a chord simply by speaking to the stark divide in American society between the 1% and the 99%. Their slogan, "We are the 99%, cut to the very heart of the economic crises ripping through the United States. The joblessness, the government budgets being slashed, and the monstrous weight to many states of the prison industrial complex, the biggest such system on earth. Similar crises are being thrust on to many European states, say Greece, Italy, and Portugal, just for starters. What we're seeing is the boundless appetite of capital for more capital, especially in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. These economic disruptions are having a political effect, as shown by the rise of anti-capitalist groupings which challenge the status quo. As these contradictions in society become sharper, more people are drawn into such movements to try to redirect this social decay into more productive, more social concerns. The Empire Strikes Back. National news reports have shown a campaign of repression against occupiers, from police assaults, beatings, mass arrests, and anti-Occupy media propaganda. First, the media ignored them. Then, when there was no longer possible to do so, they maligned them. They defended their corporate owners by missed reporting on the anti-one percenters, depicting them as silly, trifling people. Police infiltrated them at every level, yet they remain involved in a variety of issues in a variety of American cities, no longer as visible and no longer amassed at open-air locations. They remain opposed to the status quo. They are searching for a way, true. But the good thing is they're still searching. They're still organizing. They're still trying to build a system that serves human needs instead of corporate needs. They are still trying. Rosa Luxemburg would be proud. Danke sehr. Hier spricht Mumia Abu-Jamal. Danke.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
David Wyckoff, Esquire, passes suddenly. The news struck like thunder in bright sunlight. Unexpected, unbelievable, shocking. David Wyckoff, anti-death penalty lawyer, died suddenly on Saturday, January 5th, completely unexpectedly. For years he worked at the Philadelphia Capitol Habeas Unit, where he practiced as a defense lawyer for the most defenseless of people, those on death row. He took a long and circuitous road to the law, for he was a mathematician and physicist and had a full career in the world of academia. He left that world to get his hands dirty as first a student and then a lawyer. And what a lawyer. Brilliant, detailed, and meticulous, David lent his mental expertise to fighting the death penalty and was co-counsel in the Rumpia versus Beard case, U.S. Third Circuit Court, and argued the Pace versus DiGuglielmo case before the U.S. Supreme Court. But whether his name appeared in a brief or no, his hand and head strengthened countless cases, and his assistance reached far and wide throughout death row. His colleagues at the Capitol Habeas Unit and throughout the defense bar are devastated by his passing. The men and women of death row have lost a powerful advocate and ally. David leaves behind the loves of his life, his wife, Debbie Friedman, deputy director of the city's community legal services, and two boys, Isaac and Jacob. It isn't often that someone leaves the Ivy League to battle in the rough and tumble of courtrooms. David did so with a fine distinction. He will long be remembered. David Wyckoff, Esquire. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Forward by Mumia Abu-Jamal. A trial is an odd thing. When you think about it, in most cases, the witness stand is filled with strangers, people whom you've never seen or who may have never seen you. Why they are testifying is often more important a question than what they are testifying about. And the motivations can be as varied as life itself. And it may take years to discern. as people are learning every day, some witnesses are forced to testify in order to escape or have leniency granted for a pending criminal case. I didn't know the woman, Veronica Jones, who testified at my trial on June 29, 1982, but the look on her face denoted her surprise and confusion. She radiated a vibration that she didn't want to be there. It would be years before we learned why. She was blackmailed with the threat of prison and a mother's ultimate fear, separation from her babies, to get her on the stand. And still, she did not fold. She did not say what the government wanted her to say, in spite of ungodly pressures. What courage! She fought back in the only way she could. Veronica Jones resisted. I did not know the slender brown woman on the stand beyond name, supposed profession, age, and address. But I wish I did. I wish I could have hugged her. I would have told her how proud I was of her, her spirit, her fire. But I never got the chance. When you read her words, I bet you'll want to hug her too. For she was a remarkable woman who fought many battles in her long life, losing some, but fighting still. Let this work, blessed into being by her loving sister, Valerie, be her testament. When next you see a news article describing someone's life, think of this book and Veronica Jones's life, and you'll know how little you know. Thank you, Veronica. With belated love, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
We were listening to Come Sunday with Duke Ellington and Mahalia Jackson, and a brief story about that particular song is I was in Detroit, and I bought a copy of that, and I remember bringing it to the people I was staying with, some very dear friends of mine, and they laughed at me because of, Mahalia Jackson. But I think Mahalia Jackson made a tremendous contribution to our struggle for African liberation. And joining me on the line from Los Angeles, California, is Kumasi of the Black August Organizing Committee. And we're going to pay tribute to Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. Kumasi, how are you doing?
I'm all right, Norman. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm wonderful. We wanted to pay tribute to Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. And Bunchy Carter was a multifaceted human being. And a lot of people don't realize that Bunchy was could swim. He was a singer, political scientist, a great freedom fighter, of course, but he also was a poet, and I wanted to get you to recite one of Bunchy's poems, and we're going to do some poetry while we talk about Bunchy, but the first one I think we wanted to do was, what's the name of the poem? I'm losing it.
Mad One.
The Mad One, right. so you can recite the mad one. Thank you.
They say you're mad because you won't spread your ass to be a part of Charlie Black's middle class. You know the shame that Brother Malcolm claimed in glory's name. You haven't accepted the fact that because you're black, you was born to be a slave. You felt the pain. You know the shame. To skin, grin, shuck, and buck. You won't sing the tune of Mr. Coon nor march and pray till judgment day. You won't sell your soul to integrate. Don't give a damn if they separate. They say you mad.
That was Al Prince Bunchy Carter, who was the Deputy Minister of Defense of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party. We wanted to pay tribute to Al Prince Bunchy Carter today. And Al Bunchy's birthday, 69th birthday, was on October the 12th. Could you tell me a little bit about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter? Now, you grew up in the same area that Bunchy grew up in.
Well, I grew up down the street from Bunchy, but Bunchy was 4.5 years, almost 5 years older than me. So it was only because I knew his younger brothers like Jewel and played ball in front of, you know, football in the street in front of his house. We went to the Fox Theater together and stuff like that. But even though I ran with people much older than myself back in those days, he also went to the YMCA with me. I didn't run with Bunchy like a partner of his, okay, like Bo Cloud and Sinbad and all of them. I just knew him. I was pretty much in the shadow of Bunchy, kind of like
right,
following behind him and the guys his age. But one of the things I want to say is that poem and all of the poems that are popular that Bunchy did, he wrote those poems around 1964, 65, 66, between 1964 and 66 while he was in prison. So that shows you how far back his thinking, his progressive thinking goes, and his black consciousness and his militant attitude. It goes way back, because as a matter of fact, there are stories that Bunchy found himself while he was doing time in San Quentin and started reading books and discovered his negritude and, you know, developed his black consciousness and his revolutionary ideas, but they don't understand that Bunchy joined the Nation of Islam when he was 16 years old in 1958. He was one of the junior FOI.
Right, and that came, they came to Temple 27 in Los Angeles, I guess. That's when Malcolm...
Actually, before Temple 27 was organized. This is when the Nation were having clandestine meetings in people's homes. They met down on Jefferson in Normandy in the back of the Herald Dispatch office, newspaper office. And Muhammad Speak hadn't been organized yet, so their publications of their articles, ideas, philosophy, and self-help programs, all of that was being published through the Pittsburgh...
Courier.
The Pittsburgh Courier, yeah. So there were businesses, black businesses, that were mainstream, that on one hand did some black mainstream stuff, and on the other hand, out the back door, and then under the cover of darkness, that did some very serious militant work.
Right. And you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Richmond. I'm speaking to Kumasi, who is a member of the Black August Organizing Committee. Boy, we have limited time, so I really wanted to let people know that Bunchy was killed on January 17, 1969, and when he was killed, he actually asked you, or Huey P. Newton, pardon me, asked you to replace Bunchy as the Deputy Minister of Defense of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party. I wanted to get you to explain that and then do another poem by Bunchy.
Well, Huey was in CMC East Prison. I was in San Quentin. And one of our homeboys, Kenny Favorite. I don't know if you remember Kenny Favorite.
Probably knew if I saw him.
Okay. Well, Kenny Favorite stayed over a few blocks in Bunchy, over in what we call the Renegade Court. And he was a member of the Black Panther Party. And Huey would send Charles Gary, the Panther attorney, to San Quentin to visit Kenny Favorite. And it was through Kenny that I was getting the messages from Huey that had been taken a visiting room at CMC. He would talk to Attorney Charles Gary. He would take his comments, bring them to San Quentin, play the tape recorder to Kenny Favorite. Kenny Favorite would come out on the yard and give me the message. And so Huey had gotten word about a number of us in the black prison movement. He started hearing about George. He heard about me. He heard about a lot of people. And so I was out of Los Angeles. So he asked me to consider very strongly going back to L.A. and stepping into Bunchy's vacancy. There was no deputy minister at the time of the Black Panther Party for Los Angeles. That position was vacant. This was before Geronimo stepped in.
Right.
At the behest of David Hilliard, the chief of staff, who was up in Oakland. But anyway, I declined because I told him that me and Crook were very close.
Ron Wilkins.
Yeah, that me and him was as crooked as him and as Huey was to Bobby, and that if I would leave prison, I would go and join SNCC. I would be with Rap Brown and them. And I knew there was some things going on with SNCC that he did not know. I knew they were a lot more militant than he gave them credit for. And that's why I said, because of my comradeship with Crook, I would put my energy with the SNCC people. And he finally sent me word after we went back and forth several times. He sent me word. The last thing he said to me was that SNCC is defunct.
Right.
You know, which I took as him saying, you don't have any other choice. SNCC don't exist no more. So the only thing open to you for the kind of work you want to put in is the Black Panther Party, and you should still, you know, fill that vacancy. But I continued to decline.
Right.
Because I was sending letters to Crook, and I was having conversations with him at the same time and asking him what he thought about it. And I was pretty much in favor of it. I just wanted his approval, you know, so to make sure it didn't create a rift between me and him. And he just kept saying there were things that I needed to know that I didn't know because I was locked up. And, you know, I should not be so hasty to make a decision. And, you know, we would table this a little later. In the meantime, you know, events were taking place and history was moving forward. So it just never happened, and Geronimo stepped in.
All right, you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm speaking with Kumasi from Los Angeles, California. And I guess I should let people know that I went to LACC with Bunchy. And I'm basically the same age as you, but I spent a little time with Bunchy on the campus before he went to UCLA, and I heard him read poetry all the time. And you had another poem that you wanted to read by to blow by Bunchy, I think.
Yeah, this poem is one that I've never heard anybody else recite. I've never heard anyone discuss it, but I came across it while I was in Soledad. And I don't know the name of it, but I want to share parts of it with you so I can share, again, some of his thinking processes and where he was coming from. This is a poem that was written to some woman. I don't even know her name, and I forgot the name. It was mentioned in the poem, but I don't even have that line in my head, so I'll just go around it. But it says, I have loved before. A girl so rare, as a flower she had never a chance to wear. A queen, a precious thing that set my heart aglow, burning with the rage of an inferno. And though I truly loved her more than any other could, I treated her as any slave in bondage would. For when she was in need and begged that I stay near, I sought to escape and ran into the maze. Frantically, I tried hiding everywhere, but even in my sleep, I saw her there. But I am at fault, I must confess, and for my crime, my wretched soul shall never rest. But I know that sweetness fills the air somewhere, rare as the flower I had never a chance to wear. So I don't know the name of that poem, and the sister's name was mentioned in that poem somewhere, but that line, or there's a couple of lines that I don't even remember, so I just avoided it.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about ideology. You know, the Black Panther Party was it was like the African National Congress in the sense that you had many people with various ideologies. They were united, I guess, around being anti-imperialist and wanting to, you know, deal with the imperialist system and create a new black world. But, for example, George Jackson was, we could say George was like a Marxist. He was into Fanon, Mao Zedong. Huey was very similar. Eldridge Cleaver, many people said that Eldridge was an anarchist. He was into Bakunin. Bobby Seale, for all practical purpose, could be described as a social democrat. And Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, and a lot of the other Panthers were like revolutionary nationalists in the sense that they were not anti-communist or anti-Marxist, but they were really more nationalistic. Could you talk about that in terms of Al Prentice Bunchy Carter's ideology?
Okay. Well, let me say also that George Jackson believed in Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought.
Right, okay.
Bunchy, I don't believe, was a Marxist-Leninist. I don't think he was in opposition to Marxist-Leninism. I don't think he was in opposition to Mao Zedong thought, because remember, he joined the Red Guard, and the Red Guard was a Maoist organization with a lot of discipline and regimentation. Bunchy, from what I understand, was more into gasoline than the Haitian Revolution. And the whole personification, the whole personality of Dessalines. Dessalines was known not to even look into the eyes of the slave master. And if he did meet him eyeball to eyeball, it was because he was going to kill him. All right? Other than that, it was not because he was afraid to look him in the eyes. It was his contempt for him.
Right.
You know, that allowed him not to look him in the eye, because he knew if I make eye contact with him, I'm going to take his life. Bunchy's attitude was exactly the same. This is why in his Mother's Day poem, he makes the statement that a slave of natural death who died cannot balance the weight of two dead flies. And as Eldridge would say, such a one should be pitied and not mourned. And so when I come to Solidarity, the brothers in the African history and culture class who would come under the ideological persuasion of Bunchy and Eldridge were going around saying, in essence, that the stains of slavery could not be washed away except with blood, and that they were looking forward to their blood, their baptismal blood bath. Okay? They look forward, and Bunchy looked forward to the day that blacks would have the nerve to rise up and fight in a war of liberation and would liberate themselves through combat, not through no praying, not through no begging for mercy or asking anybody to deliver them and to redeem them, that they had to redeem themselves. And the only way to redeem yourself was to take part in this baptismal blood bath. Okay, Mau Mau style. And that was the other thing. Bunchy liked the Mau Mau struggle and the Mau Mau
Didon Kimathi.
He liked Didon Kimathi and the whole Mau Mau approach to liberation through practicing freedom fighting. Fighting. Not talking about it, but fighting.
Right, right.
And the same thing with George. George saw himself as someone who would someday lead the military division of the Black Liberation Movement. And so his whole thing, he practiced, he thought, and he strategized for guerrilla warfare. And he's the one that gave us the slogan, "Long live the guerrilla." So Bunchy and George, you know, you say they were like Dessalines and Henry Christophe.
And Bunchy did, Bunchy was a real brother that didn't stood up to the prison guards. I know you used to always talk about how he used to wouldn't
crazy to the prison guards. They would tell me stories like he's walking down the hallway and the prison guards be posted up somewhere and ask him, "Where you going?" And he would turn around and tell them things like, "Tucker Wood, I'm still in the penitentiary, ain't I? What do you mean, where am I going?" He just talked so disdainfully to him. And he's the one that when he was going to a parole board, and they said, "We understand that, Mr. Carter, that you think we're devil." And he lowered his head, and he looked back up. And this is the story, the legend. They say, he told him, he said, this is at a time when Black folks, man, were afraid to even look these people in the eye, man. They, you know, always had their eyes downcast, their ears up around, their shoulders up around their ears, scratching their head, shuffling, you know, around. Serious. And Bunchy, at that time, looked them straight in their eyes and told them, "I don't think you're no devil. I know damn well you're the devil." And they still let him go home. You know, but he showed that type of a contempt for their authority. He, at all times, was belligerent towards them. And he had total command of himself. And he was disciplined, alert, forthright, unbending. And that was his status and his stature and his reputation.
All right, you're listening to Diasporic Music. We have about 10 minutes left now. Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was born in Shreveport, Louisiana, and there's another person that really has been kind of lost in the sauce, and I'm speaking of Masai Hewitt, was also born in Shreveport, Louisiana. I think Masai was called Bright Eyes, but I knew Masai, I guess I can say this now, but Masai was one of the people that helped me get out of the United States, but he became the Minister of Education for the Black Panther Party. Could you talk about a little bit about, you know, what they call, used to call Masai Bright Eyes and Bunchies, their relationship?
Well, they were very close. They were both renegade sloths, and they stayed in close proximity to one another. They grew up together. Masai at some point joined the Marine Corps and came back, and then I think it was Masai that was in the Red Guard.
He was, right.
Bunchy.
Right.
Yeah, when Bunchy come out of prison, Masai pulled Bunchy into the Red Guard. And so Masai had a very strong educational background, a force of intellect. He could articulate the ideology, the philosophy, and the history of revolutions and revolutionary parties around the world. And so one of our obligations was, if you were going to be a revolutionary, then you had to study and examine the history of revolutions all over the world, the Chinese Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the French bourgeois revolution, the Cuban Revolution. You know, you had to absorb that information and understand their approach to educating themselves, taking on nom de guerre, rejecting the establishment and the mainstream of the dominant society that kept freedom from them. And what means they use to acquire their freedom. you know. So how they had to learn first how to think like free people and act like free people, and then go about the process of freeing themselves from all dominant rulership that was oppressive. And so my side was one of those people who had that kind of knowledge, had that kind of information, and could share it, could teach it, and at the same time had already embodied it.
Well, yeah, my side, when Eldridge Cleaver came to California, when he came to Los Angeles, shortly after he came out of prison, he came to a place called a teen post, and Masai was there, Bunchy was there, and I happened to be there myself, and Eldridge Cleaver, yeah, that's when the first time I saw Eldridge. But we have about 7 minutes left, and I wanted to say that I'd like to thank Keisha for the technical knowledge now, and I wanted to let you use the time the best way you know how to use the time. Is there anything else you would like to add? I'm speaking with Kamasi of the Black August Organizing Committee, and if there's another poem you wanted to run, and you know, your concluding thoughts, and I think we might have to do this again with some more people. You've already suggested that we get some more people in to talk about Bunchy.
Yeah. The reason why I chose those poems earlier to try to reflect on Bunchy's attitude and thinking, I think it's important to understand that when you look at Soul on Ice, which Eldridge wrote, which is a collection of Eldridge's letters and essays, that he and Bunchy shared the same attitude about the fact that black men, for so long, had abandoned their obligation as men, their role as men, and in fact, as long as they were not free, could not even act like men. And so his poems and Eldridge's essays, if you study them, you will see that they apologize over and over again, especially to the black woman, for not having been man enough. That's why he opens up black mothers by saying, I must confess that I still grieve, and you are not yet free. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So, having looked at all the different ways that freedom has been kept from us, and understanding that this is a violent and a very forceful process of keeping us in our place and diminishing our respect for ourselves, our ideas about who we are, so that we cannot gather and collect ourselves well enough to put the kind of starch in our pants that will allow us to fulfill our sense of mission, that in order to begin on this path of fighting for your freedom, then you got to be a whole lot of man. And you have to undo all the unmanly damage that you have allowed yourself, okay, to do to yourself and your kind. And so they used to always talk about how brothers would come into penitentiary and they would brag about how they used to beat up on their woman, you know, call her all kind of names and tell her, I'm a man. But then get in the car with her, go out in the street, the police officer will pull them over, and he sit behind the wheel trembling, and she's looking at him like 5 minutes ago when it was just me and you. You was a man. In front of this guy, you ain't acting like no man. So one of the things we had to insist, and Bunchy and Eldridge insisted upon, and I followed up with the same program, was that at all times you carry yourself like a man. And I don't care who comes in front of you. I don't care how well armed he is. I don't care what his status. I don't care what his rank. I don't care who he is in the world. You have to accept the fact that he is no more man than you, and you have to represent yourself at least as his equal. And always talk to him eyeball to eyeball, square your shoulders, And if he's a general, you have to let him know that on your side of the table, you are a general and you are an ambassador for your race, and that's what you represent, and you are not in any way less than him, and you don't let him talk down to you. And you don't let him abuse you, and you don't let him use you in any kind of way. And you stand on that as long as you can, and if you have to, you take that to the grave with you. But if there's a conflict between you and him, and he decides he's going to oppress you, or he's going to talk down to you, or he's going to belittle you and your status, and especially in front of your woman, or your race, then one of you got to go to the grave.
And that is, I think that sums it up, pretty much sums it up in the... Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Not at this time.
So we appreciate you coming on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we will definitely talk to you later, and definitely want to, well, I guess you should mention the fact that people are working on, there's a young man in Los Angeles working on a book on Bunchy. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Lyndon Beckford is working now on the file.
And this is Saturday Morning Live, and you're listening to Radio Regent. This is Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen. You had been listening to Diasporic Music. That was an interview that Norman Otis Richmond did October 23rd of 2010, and he was talking about Bunchy Carter, who was assassinated January 17th, 1969, and he was talking with Kumasi, who was actually Carter's replacement as the Minister of Defense of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party.